ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump says he's made up his mind on which tariffs to impose today. A design to help American manufacturers, although economists say it will also raise prices. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Layoff notices went out at the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. It's gutting teams who study rare diseases, fertility treatments, and help with HIV prevention and tobacco rules. Also, Congress gets jammed up as Cory Booker breaks the record for longest Senate speech, and the House Speaker tries to stop remote voting by new parents. It's Wednesday, April 2nd, which is when modern daytime soap started back in 1956 with the premieres of The Edge of Night and As the World Turns. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Stocks continued their downward slide this morning in advance of President Trump's big tariff announcement this afternoon. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 110 points in early trading.
The stock market has been flashing a warning sign about the president's trade policy for weeks, but so far the White House appears undeterred. Economists warn widespread tariffs will raise prices for businesses and consumers in the U.S. while slowing economic growth and possibly costing jobs. Nevertheless, President Trump is set to push ahead with a tariff announcement in the White House Rose Garden this afternoon. Gasoline prices continue to climb as crude oil prices hover just above $70 a barrel. AAA says the average price at the pump for regular gas is about $3.24 a gallon. That's up 9 cents from a week ago, but still about 30 cents lower than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker has set a record by giving the longest ever speech on the Senate floor. The Democrat started a 25-hour speech Monday evening by referencing the late civil rights leader John Lewis about doing good work through creating good trouble. Booker repeated himself last night when he concluded his record speech.
This is a moral moment. It's not left or right. It's right or wrong. It's getting good trouble. My friend, Madam President, I yield the floor.
Booker, a black American, has surpassed the prior record of segregationist Senator Strom Thurmond. In 1957, Thurmond filibustered for 24 hours against the Civil Rights Act. Two Republican candidates have won decisively in the special congressional elections in Florida. They were endorsed by President Trump. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
In the first congressional district on Florida's panhandle, the state's former chief financial officer, Jimmy Patronis, defeated Democrat Gay Valamont by 15 points. That margin of victory is 17 points narrower than in November when she ran against Matt Gaetz, who left Congress several weeks later. In the 6th district on Florida's East Coast, Republican Randy Fine beat Democrat Josh Wheel by about 14 points. That's a significantly narrower margin than that seen by then-Congressman Mike Waltz in November, who defeated his Democratic opponent by 33 points. Florida's Democratic Party chair says that the results are, quote, a historic overperformance, and that voters are rejecting Trump's agenda. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
In another closely watched nonpartisan election, a liberal candidate has won election to Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. Susan Crawford won comfortably. Billionaire Elon Musk had poured millions of his own money into the race to support her conservative opponent. But Musk is also pointing to a measure Wisconsin voters passed to enshrine voter ID requirements into the Wisconsin state constitution. Again on Wall Street, the Dow was down about 113 points. This is NPR. The military government running the country of Myanmar now says more than 2,800 people have been killed in last Friday's earthquake. Thousands of others are injured. A man was pulled from the rubble of a hotel in Myanmar's capital, but hope is fading for the rescue of others. The quake also killed more than 20 people in neighboring Thailand. In the U.S., the National Weather Service says a significant storm is headed for the central part of the country. Forecasters in Kentucky say Louisville could get significant rain. They're also worried about wind gusts up to 50 miles per hour. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says that states should stop letting people use federal food aid to buy soda. NPR's Katie Riddle reports some food policy experts are skeptical.
One thing most people who study this issue agree on, too much sugary soda is bad, and it's contributing to chronic health problems in America. But some say that banning soda just isn't the most effective strategy to address this issue. Joel Berg is CEO of an organization called Hunger Free America.
I think it's fair to say there are people who are well-meaning, who are truly concerned about public health, who support this. And it's also true that there are people who are not well-meaning that just want to punish poor people.
Berg says to truly impact public health, nutritious food needs to be more accessible and affordable. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Actor Val Kilmer has died at the age of 65. His daughter says Kilmer died of pneumonia in Los Angeles. He had previously recovered from throat cancer. Kilmer starred in numerous films, including Top Gun and The Doors. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Total Wine & More. For discovering something new, like a Cabernet or single barrel bourbon, learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It's a big news day, as they all seem to be anymore. Glad you're with us once again this morning. In the next few minutes, we have an analysis of President Trump's planned tariffs. And we also ask who was fired at the Department of Health and Human Services. We also have election results.
President Trump was not on the ballot, but elections in two states are being viewed as an early indicator of how voters feel about him after his first few months in office. In Florida, Republicans hung on to two congressional seats in deeply red districts, cementing their slim majority in the U.S. House.
Solid wins for Republicans, although the margins were a little bit less than they were just last year. In Wisconsin, in what became the most expensive judicial race in American history, the liberal judge Susan Crawford was elected to the state Supreme Court. She beat conservative Brad Schimmel, who ran with Trump's endorsement, and some $20 million from Elon Musk, along with groups affiliated with him. Here's Crawford last night.
As a little girl growing up in Chippewa Falls, I never could have imagined that I'd be taking on the richest man in the world. For justice in Wisconsin. And we won!
Chuck Kornbach of member station WUWM joins me now from Milwaukee. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning.
Okay, so what happened in the race?
Well, in the end, the liberal judge from Madison, Crawford, won with a comfortable margin, about 235,000 votes, 9 percentage points over Schimmel, the conservative judge from suburban Milwaukee. Crawford even took some counties that have gone pretty often for Republicans in recent years, including Brown County, that's mainly Green Bay, where Elon Musk held a rally Sunday night. One of the other big stories from last night was the surge in voter turnout on both sides. Early voting and in-person voting exceeded many clerks' expectations. And of course, there was the spending. Both sides spent really big. You know, Musk and groups associated with him spent about $20 million. Crawford had a lot of money to spend, though, too, including from mega donors like George Soros, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker.
Now, Elon Musk became a big part of this race, as you point out, and Trump's endorsement, too. Anything to take away from Schimmel's loss in that regard?
Well, a few things. This race, even though it was the court is nonpartisan, it was definitely a win for Democrats, and they're claiming victory against the president, his administration, and Musk. And I heard that from voters, too. They say Musk's Doge effort is going too fast, too broadly. From young voters, though, I also heard a lot about reproductive rights, which was the big issue in the last state Supreme Court election we had here 2 years ago. For more conservative voters, I heard support for the president and for Musk, and that Schimmel could protect Trump's policies and agenda. The state GOP says they're disappointed about last night, but are looking forward to 2026, when they say they'll have the opportunity to defend President Trump's agenda in more elections.
Okay, so back to the court. Liberals have kept their majority. What cases are expected to go before the justices?
Well, abortion is already in front of the court. They're going to have to decide soon on whether an 1849 Wisconsin law that halted abortions here for 15 months right after the Dobbs decision is constitutional. Next, the matter of Act 10. That's the big fight from 15 years ago that curtailed union bargaining rights for most public sector workers. The court could decide if parts of that law are unconstitutional. And one issue we heard a lot about from Musk and was congressional redistricting, his contention that Democrats would try to pick up a couple of U.S. House seats here. Democrats told me last night when I asked about this, hey, we want to enjoy Crawford's win, and our lawyers will decide whether to pursue the redistricting issue before a court that will stay 4-3 liberal.
Chuck Kornbach of member station WUWM. Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you.
The president has made a lot of tariff news in recent months, imposing, removing, changing, re-announcing tariffs day by day, but he contends that this is the big day. Liberation Day, the president calls it, when the U.S. imposes tariffs on nations around the world. He casts these taxes as retribution for trade barriers on Americans in those countries, while also saying the tariffs will force the world to invest in U.S. jobs.
I think that we're going to be at $5 trillion of investment. I think you're going to have investments very shortly. We're already 3.5, and we have commitments, verbal commitments, for a lot more.
It's unclear where those numbers come from. Diane Swonk joins us next. She is chief economist for KPMG US, the big accounting firm. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Let's be clear. We don't know exactly what the president will announce, but there's been a lot of talk. So what is the general shape of what we can expect today?
Well, what we're expecting today is across-the-board tariffs on a good portion of the countries we trade with. And I think that's important to understand, is we're talking about some level of tariffs, and they've been talked about at different levels, so we don't know exactly which ones, but it's going to likely cover in a very blanketed way, not specific products, but a lot of countries, almost every country that we trade with.
We've heard of talk of the administration giving every country a number. We think you're this unfair, and so it's a 10% tariff for you or a 20% tariff for you. Is that what we expect here?
We're not entirely sure on that, but that has been one of the things that's been discussed. It could be 10% on all tariffs. It could be 20% on all countries. We don't know exactly what he's going to announce today, but there will be some level of tariffs on most of the trade coming into the U.S. as of the end of the day.
Why has the stock market seemed so nervous about the prospect of these taxes?
Because at the end of the day, tariffs are a regressive tax. Not only do they tax those who can afford it least, they also tend to trigger reactions by our trading partners and can trigger a trade war. And they cause inflation and stem growth at the same time. That's stagflationary. And that's something we've not seen since the 1970s. They do that because the margins, what happens is they hit profit margins. So the stock market, of course, doesn't like that. They hit demand because they increase prices, and the stock market doesn't like that. And then they also hurt trade and exports of our producers exporting to other countries because other countries retaliate.
I want to understand this, though, the effect on American consumers. The president originally said American consumers will be unaffected, foreigners will pay. We were just reporting in China, we were talking with people who export to the U.S., and it turns out that some exporters will pick up some of the cost, but not all of the cost. And the administration has now acknowledged that in many cases prices will go up. The Treasury Secretary has talked about people paying several $1,000s more for a car. The president has said, I don't care if people pay more for a car. And the argument is that there will be benefits on the other side, that there will be more American jobs or higher American wages. Can the math work out here?
It's something that historically has never worked out in the ways in which people had hoped. And this is one, you've got tariffs looking for so many different ways to a blunt tool to solve a lot of problems, which when you're doing so many things simultaneously, the law of unintended consequences kicks in. But we know, for instance, from the 2018-2019 tariffs, higher tariffs on steel did create more jobs in the steel sector, but at the expense of overall manufacturing jobs, because inputs costs went up and manufacturers actually slipped into a manufacturing recession. We also know all of the tariffs in 2018 and 2019 showed up in the price of washing machines and then some. They showed up in dryers, which were not tariffed, but were sold with washing machines. Hmm. And so that's how they're just not the kinds of solutions that we really need to our problems. They sound good, but the reality is that they have a lot of unintended consequences, and we've studied them for decades, literally over 100 years. And in fact, the last time we had any kind of tariffs of this magnitude, they weren't inflationary. They were initiated a little, almost a year into the Great Depression. Hmm. They triggered 25 countries' trade wars and a 67% decline in global trade, plunging us deeper into the Great Depression.
Diane Swonk is chief economist for KPMG US. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Some other news now. The Trump administration has begun a round of layoffs at the Department of Health and Human Services. Thousands of employees were fired just yesterday. It's NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports the process has been chaotic.
Secretary of Health Robert F. Kennedy Jr. explained last week he wants to dramatically overhaul the department he oversees and cut the workforce by a total of 20,000 employees, almost 25% of staff. He said the focus would be on streamlining administrative work and promised it would not affect things like FDA inspections or Medicare services, but there weren't a lot of details about the reduction in force or RIFs. Then, early Tuesday morning,
I woke up to multiple text messages that they received a RIF notice, so I went online and saw my email.
That's Jennifer Honig, who works for SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. She's a statistician who oversees a national survey on drug use and health. Some HHS employees missed those emails and texts, so they headed into work. At several federal buildings, there were lines of workers snaking around the block, and many found out they had been fired when they tried to badge into the building and their badge didn't work. Here's Honig again.
Someone on my team specifically, he was able to badge in like normal. And then he went upstairs and got the RIF notice.
She was shocked that her whole team was cut. She says the survey she runs has been happening for decades. It's required by Congress and provides key information about substance use so that state and local stakeholders can make policy decisions. They had already gathered the data.
So we don't know what will happen because there's no statisticians left in our center.
Honig's team was just one of many to get cut. Others include disability services, tobacco regulation, rare disease research, HIV prevention, fertility research, occupational safety, even help for heating bills for elderly and disabled people. Very high-ranking NIH directors were given an offer to transfer to the Indian Health Service and given the option of several remote posts.
I mean, I'll just say it. I think it's a way to try to get people to quit.
That's Dr. Phil Huang, director of Dallas County Health and Human Services in Texas, at a press briefing on how the cuts will affect local public health. On social media, Kennedy said it was a difficult moment, but he wrote HHS was spending too much money and Americans weren't getting healthier, so they had to shift course. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is in force, and students are in the crosshairs at college campuses nationwide, from Columbia to the University of Alabama. Legal scholar Daniel Canstrom joins us to unpack the law, the history, and the human cost. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. In a new movie, Paul Rudd and Jenna Ortega play a father and daughter driving deep into the wilderness when they hit a unicorn. It's rare, but it happens.
However, when I did hit the unicorn, I wasn't sure if it was totally dead, and then I bludgeoned it with a tire iron just to put it out of its misery.
Yeah, as one does.
Yeah, you know, it's thoughtful, but gruesome.
That's Paul Rudd basically summarizing the whole movie. Thoughtful, but gruesome. As it turns out, hitting a unicorn isn't quite like hitting a squirrel. Unicorns are a lot more vengeful and organized. What starts out as a dark comedy turns into a unicorn gore fest.
You're gonna kill us.
Death of a Unicorn is written and directed by Alex Sharfman. He and Paul Rudd joined me recently through a smartphone app, and you'll understand why I told you that in a moment.
I really had no interest in unicorns at the outset, but it sort of led me down a rabbit hole of exploration of unicorn mythology and unicorn lore. And, you know, at some point it clicked into place that it was a way to tell a kind of contemporary version of a creature feature and kind of do my own version of it was the exciting thing that really jump-started the writing process.
And also, I had no idea that the lore around unicorns was that they are these vengeful creatures. Because my experience with unicorns is like My Little Pony unicorns.
Yeah, well, most of our experience with unicorns today is My Little Pony stuff. But the truth is, you know, that only goes back like 50, 75 years.
Did we lose Alex? Alex?
I think he might have just been impaled by a unicorn.
Oh, yeah.
Look, this is good. Honestly, can I tell you about Alex?
Yeah, like, tell me the truth.
Oh, this guy. Oh, God. It's all unicorns with this guy. Honestly, he's going to tell you this whole
bit. Is it better now?
Oh, hey, he's back. He's back. Yes. Hey, we can hear you. Yeah. All right. Great.
Okay, good.
Yes. And Paul was not saying anything rude while you were gone.
No, I was singing your praises.
Okay, so you were saying that only goes back 50 or 75 years, and then I lost you.
Oh, yeah. We've had them in our Western culture for almost 2,500 years. The first written account of a unicorn was around 400 BC. But it used to be, for most of human history, it used to be very different, and it used to have this much more primal, much more kind of ancient god kind of quality to it.
So they discover this unicorn. You've thrown it in the trunk after bludgeoning it. You play a fairly timid lawyer who's dragging his daughter to a wilderness preserve, and it's owned by a wealthy big pharma family he's trying to do business with. And you take it to the home of this really wealthy family.
I know a lot of species in this area are rare, but is this exact, familiar to you?
Familiar to us? No. This is new.
What exactly are we saying this is, though?
I think we know exactly what it is.
What I can say with total confidence is Elliot here has hit a horse-like mammalia, vertebralia, would that be the correct classification?
No, but it is horse-shaped with some sort of protrusion or a growth.
Right, that's my working theory, too. Feral horse. Mad, tumor-ridden, jumps in the middle of the road. Not the fault of any one driver, per se.
It's a unicorn.
that family discovers the unicorn's body has healing properties and it puts your character in a bind. If you could talk about that and what happens between you and your daughter, played by Jenna Ortega Ridley.
Yes, well, I'm playing this guy, Elliot, who is a father first and also a recently widowed father. And in an effort, I think, to be a good parent and make sure that we're taken care of, securing some kind of deal here with this family is important. Obviously, listening to your child and making the correct moral decisions is also important. And I think my character spends a great deal of this film kind of with one foot in each camp and trying his best to balance it out and do what he believes is really right in the long run, because he knows best, or so he thinks.
One of the themes in the movie seems to be greed disguised as altruism.
It's an opportunity for immortality.
We have a moral imperative to harvest every last one.
Where did you draw from there, Alex, writing that into the movie?
You know, I think that notion is just something that I think is kind of hopefully tied also to, like, you know, Paul's character's arc too, is this question of moral relativism and a little bit of, like, do the ends justify the means, and can we convince ourselves of that what we want to do is maybe more morally appropriate or acceptable than it actually is, and trying to, you know, how we all kind of go about our daily lives of maybe convincing ourselves that what we're after is more honorable than perhaps it could be.
The unicorns are scary, but the humans might be just as scary, the really wealthy ones.
Yes, that was part of the thinking, was like, what, a monster movie where the real monsters are the people?
Yeah. And Paul, you've had this really successful long career in film. How much horror have you done, I was wondering?
Some of the things I've done could be described that way, but unintentionally, I would say. When it comes to actual technical horror, not that much. This was maybe the second. I don't really know. You know, the very first movie I ever did was a Halloween movie. Okay. And that was terrifying for a number of reasons. But yeah, it was somewhat new to me. I hadn't had a ton of experience working on scary stuff.
Is there a genre you're like, no, this, I'll never do this?
Snuff films. I put my foot down. I said, that's it. I won't do it.
A moral stance.
That's where I draw the line. Other than that, my line is always open. And email me, call, text.
I was going to send you my new script too, Paul, and now I'm not going to.
I'm sorry. I'm very busy.
Paul Rudd is one of the stars of the new movie Death of a Unicorn, and it was written and directed by Alex Sharfman. Thank you to you both, and congratulations.
Thank you
so much.
It was nice talking with you.
This is NPR News.
Spring has sprung. It's the perfect time to go outside and dive into a great book, like King of Ashes by S.A. Cosby.
That's a southern crime drama inspired by The Godfather. You know, there's like an ailing patriarch, a family that's falling apart, and a son just to come back and pull everything together.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Fiction for Spring on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Wisconsin's state Supreme Court will retain its liberal majority following yesterday's special election. Circuit Court Judge Susan Crawford defeated a conservative county judge in the race for an open seat on the state's highest court. Anya Van Wangtendonk with Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Susan! Susan!
Crawford was declared the winner a little after 9 p.m. local time, following a bruising election cycle estimated to cost more than $100 million. Much of that money came from Elon Musk in support of Crawford's conservative opponent, Brad Schimmel. In her victory speech, Crawford described that campaign as an attack on democracy.
And Wisconsins stood up and said loudly that justice does not have a price. Our courts are not for sale.
Crawford's win cements a liberal majority on the swing state's high court, with lawsuits affecting abortion and labor law at stake. For NPR News, I'm Anya Van Wagendonk in Madison.
In Florida, voters in a pair of special congressional elections, one along the state's East Coast and another in the Panhandle, have chosen Republicans to fill the open House seats. They were vacated by the resignations of GOP Congressman Mike Waltz and Matt Gaetz. Waltz is currently serving as President Trump's national security advisor. This is NPR News from Washington. This afternoon at the White House, President Trump is expected to unveil his latest round of tariffs. Despite warnings from economists that tariffs raise prices for American consumers, the president backs them as a way to incentivize companies to do business in the U.S. and boost manufacturing jobs. Forecasters say strong storms in the areas of the Midwest and South today could produce baseball-size hail and spawn tornadoes. The National Weather Service says flash flooding is also a possibility. As climate change heats up the planet, scientists are researching how much heat the human body can withstand. NPR's Alejandra Barunda says a new study is bringing scientists closer to an answer.
Rob Mead is a scientist at Harvard who studies how the human body handles heat stress. For his recent study published in the journal PNAS, he and colleagues tested that personally. He went into a heat chamber at 107 degrees and gradually cranked up the humidity.
What it feels like is the alarm bells going off in your brain.
The researchers found that after several hours of extreme heat and humidity exposure, people's bodies passed a threshold. Beyond that, they couldn't cool themselves down anymore without getting out of the heat. But for many people worldwide, there is no way to escape that kind of heat. And climate change is going to make that number of people grow. Alejandra Barunda, NPR News.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From EasyCater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. On Friday, a lawyer plans to ask a court to order the return of his client to the United States.
President Trump's administration admits sending the man to El Salvador despite knowing about a court order preventing them from doing that. Responding to questions from reporters, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt spoke of Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia.
Well, first of all, the error that you are referring to was a clerical error. It was an administrative error.
By calling it an administrative error, the government avoids saying they deliberately defied a court order. The government goes on to assert that a judge should have no power to overrule the mistake, and the administration does not want to bring the man back anyway.
The administration maintains the position that this individual who was deported to El Salvador and will not be returning to our country was a member of the brutal and vicious MS-13 gang.
His lawyers questioned the government's claim that he is a gang member at all, says he wasn't convicted of a crime, and that he was not supposed to be sent specifically to El Salvador.
NPR's immigration policy reporter, Ximena Ostillo, has more. Hi, Ximena.
Good morning.
Okay, so tell us what we know about who Abrego Acosta is and what happened to him.
He was from El Salvador and living in Maryland with his child and his wife, who is a U.S. citizen. But Abrego Garcia already went through immigration courts. In 2019, he was served with his notice to appear before a judge. The judge found that he could be deported, but Abrego Garcia was able to make the case against being deported back to El Salvador. The government appealed, but lost. And then last month, he was apprehended by immigration officials once more. And his wife only realized that he had been transferred to a mega prison in El Salvador because she recognized his tattoos on a photo from the El Salvador government.
Okay, so the administration admits in court they knew they couldn't deport him to El Salvador, but they deported him anyways?
Yes. In court filings, immigration officials admitted that Abrego Garcia's deportation was an administrative error, but they are doubling down on his deportation. Vice President J.D. Vance alleged on social media that Abrego Garcia is a member of the MS-13 gang. Abrego Garcia's lawyer, however, disputes the claims of criminal history, noting that he's never been convicted of a crime in the U.S. or any other country, nor has there been significant evidence of his ties to the gang. His lawyers argue that the government could have deported him anywhere but El Salvador, but they ignore those earlier orders.
So what does his lawyer say about this insistence by the government that Garcia cannot be returned?
Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, who is representing Abrego Garcia, raised concerns about the implications that this has on other immigration court cases.
I mean, if they're allowed to get away with this, then it means that the immigration laws are meaningless, all of them.
On Friday, he will ask a federal judge to order the U.S. to bring Abrego Garcia back. The government is poised to argue that it's too late because Abrego Garcia is in the custody of another government. But his lawyer says that if courts cannot order him returned from a place he should legally not be, eventually the government could do the same to a U.S. citizen.
Now, are these men that have been detained and accused of crimes, like being part of a criminal gang, supposed to get due process?
Depending on where you're detained and how long you've been in the country, you could have your day in court to convince a judge that you should stay. The government brings their own attorneys to argue that you should be removed, and then people get a chance to defend themselves. Sometimes that defense can be claiming asylum or asking to not be deported to a specific country. Then a judge decides whether they agree.
And that didn't happen in these cases. NPR's Ximena Bastillo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is Wednesday, hump day as people say, and so far Congress has not accomplished much in the way of legislation. A fight over a rule for new parents effectively paralyzed the House of Representatives, prompting Republican leaders to just go home. The Senate paused for a record-breaking speech. Democrat Cory Booker of New Jersey spoke for slightly over 25 hours. NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt was there for both. Barbara, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
I'm curious about this. When you're covering a 25-hour speech, do you stay there for the whole thing, hanging on every word?
You know, I can't say that I had the same stamina as Senator Booker. I was there for parts of it, can't claim to be there for the full 25 hours.
Okay, so you broke for a nap or a bathroom break or whatever. But I saw parts of this as it went along. He was showing it on YouTube. It was on TV. So what was it like?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the stamina it takes itself is quite stunning to do something for 25 hours long. And, you know, like we were joking about, you really can't leave. You know, he can't leave to get food. He can't go to the bathroom. He'd been fasting since Friday in preparation, hadn't been drinking water. He told us afterwards that that helped avoid the bathroom issue, but did cause him to cramp up throughout the speech.
I'm very sore and weary and tired, and but I'm enormously grateful for a lot of folks who sent me their very, very personal stories. They gave me a chance to speak to the pain, hurt, fear, anger, demands of a lot of Americans.
And as you said, it was historic. He broke the 1957 record of Senator Strom Thurmond. And I think worth noting that that is significant in its own right. A black senator broke the record of someone who held the Senate floor in protest of the Civil Rights Act.
I suppose whether you think this is impressive or not might depend partly on your partisan orientation. Although some Republicans gave him credit for doing this, what do you accomplish when you talk for so long?
Well, you know, he said this came about after hearing from constituents and Democrats around the country calling on their lawmakers to do more as the opposition party. And obviously there are limitations to what Democrats can do in the minority. But Booker talked about how this was something he felt he could do that would be bold. And he wanted to share those stories of people who he says have been impacted by the actions of the Trump administration. He did not derail a nomination with his marathon speech, but he did delay the timing of it.
Oh, interesting, of the Senate approving a nominee. So what was happening in the other chamber? Would you explain how it was that the House was frozen for the week?
Yes. Yeah, so Florida Republican Anna Paulina Luna and Colorado Democrat Brittany Pedersen have a proposal that would allow lawmakers who are new parents to vote by proxy for 12 weeks around the birth of a new child. Hmm. They both have young children themselves. Pedersen was actually holding her 9-week-old during the vote.
Wow.
And Luna used something called a discharge petition to force a vote on the measure. But House Speaker Mike Johnson is really opposed to this bill. Here he is ahead of the vote.
It's unconstitutional. And there's no limiting principle. So if you allow it for some situations, you're ultimately going to have to allow it for all. And I think that destroys the deliberative nature of the body.
So he tried a maneuver of his own to block Luna, and he lost. 8 Republicans ultimately sided with her yesterday.
Today is a pretty historical day for the entire conference. It's showing that the body has decided that parents deserve a voice in Washington, and also to the importance of female members having a vote in Washington, D.C.
How did the abandonment of 8 Republicans paralyze the chamber?
Well, Johnson tried to stop the bill by tying it to other Republican bills that were going to be voted on this week, like restricting courts from issuing national injunctions. When this died on the floor, basically so did the rest of those legislative plans. So he sent everyone home for the week, said he'll regroup and come back next week, do this thing again.
Well, Barbara, I guess you'll have less to do for the rest of the week.
Wouldn't that be nice?
NPR's Barbara Sprunt.
Thank you.
She'll be covering something. This is NPR News.
Remember cup stacking? A decade ago, school kids around the country were obsessed with building pyramids with cups. It's still a big deal around the world. Next time on Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Layla Fadel. A family was taking photos of their kids here in Washington when someone walked behind the shot. Okay, maybe a little rude, but when they looked back, they noticed the photobomber was someone familiar. former President Barack Obama. He was out to see the cherry blossoms and stepped right into frame. On Instagram, he apologized. I don't think they minded. The mom told NBC he's welcome to next year's shoot, same place, same time. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Aid workers are picking through the rubble in the isolated Southeast Asian country, Myanmar, as a devastating earthquake has killed thousands there. It's worsening the humanitarian crisis fueled by the country's ongoing civil war. Elena Vuolo joins me now to discuss from the administrative capital, Naypyidaw. She's the deputy head of the World Health Organization's Myanmar office. Elena, so where do recovery efforts stand right now?
Our efforts are right now very much focusing on making sure that the trauma and surgical kits that we have already been dispatching as of Saturday are reaching hospitals or whatever is left of the hospitals that have not collapsed yet. And we're also working to make sure that this earthquake does not disrupt a health system that was already fragile, because after all, this earthquake is just an additional crisis within a very dire humanitarian situation.
What are the greatest needs for disaster relief right now? What's the thing that is needed most?
Trauma kits, surgical supplies. On Friday, I had to go to a hospital because one of our team members was in need of emergency care. There were no supplies to give stitches, for example, to my colleague. So when these infrastructures are severely damaged, the immediate need is also to find alternative options and to establish mobile hospitals, mobile operating theater rooms where surgeons can do their job. The second immediate need is to have emergency medical teams, rescue teams, teams specialized in this kind of natural disaster response. Unfortunately, today we can consider the golden window closed, meaning that it's closed, that time-bound window whereby we expect to extract people under the rubble still alive.
Usually when these kind of global disasters happen, U.S. Agency for International Development would usually just spring into action. The Trump administration gutted that agency. In place of USAID, who is providing aid now? What parties are getting together to help Myanmar today?
European donors, Asian donors. Some countries have already come forward, like India, China, Russia. The UN system through OCHA has been able, for example, to mobilize $5 million for protection, education, cash-based assistance. Unfortunately, Myanmar is also one of the least funded emergencies in the world.
What's the pace been like to get these needed supplies to the people that need it?
The situation is very difficult. It's very dire. There is a shortage of food, water, electricity, internet. We are trying still to determine what are the immediate needs, but also what are going to be the next needs in the next few weeks and months.
Elena, I remember back in 2008, Myanmar was hit by a cyclone that killed more than 140,000 people. And at the time, the military junta was criticized for not letting outside aid in. Do you think they have learned any lessons from that?
We see a higher degree of openness. As a matter of fact, there has been an appeal from the government here to the international community to bring that support. And I think that this is something that we need to appreciate, to recognize. In this given moment, we need to work with all counterparts.
That's Elena Vuolo, deputy head of the World Health Organization Myanmar office. Elena, thank you very much for this update.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Thank you.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. This afternoon at the White House, President Trump is scheduled to unveil tariffs. A lot of them. The president has said they'll apply to practically all countries that export goods to the U.S., although we do not know exactly how high those import taxes will be. What we do know is that a whole lot of U.S. allies are promising to retaliate in what could be the beginning of a far-flung trade war. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
The Trump administration says tariffs will raise revenues for the federal government and incentivize more domestic manufacturing. On Fox News over the weekend, advisor Peter Navarro said tariffs will bring in some $600 billion a year in new revenues and will be coupled with income tax cuts.
If you look at this basically holistically, as they say, consumers and Americans are going to be better off, including all the jobs they get.
But a lot of experts are not so sure. Former U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai, who served during the Biden administration, said instead of targeting allies, we should focus on the People's Republic of China, or PRC.
There are economies and countries that we need to work with to take on the common challenge of coexisting and competing successfully with the PRC economic model.
Meanwhile, the tariffs to be announced today have allies in Europe and Asia planning retaliatory measures. Add to that the uncertainty brought on by how the Trump administration has rolled out new tariffs. Doug Irwin is professor of economics at Dartmouth College with a focus on trade policies.
It's very hard to foster business investment if there's not some certainty about what policy is going to be 2, 3, 5 years down the road. That uncertainty just sort of freezes up investment rather than unleashing it.
Many analysts say they want more clarity from the administration, both on the scope of the tariffs and the objectives the White House is trying to achieve. I'm Nova Safa for Marketplace.
Johnson & Johnson has been trying for years to settle lawsuits that allege its talc baby powder caused cancer. A federal judge has rejected its latest attempt to do that. This is the third time J&J has attempted to resolve thousands of legal claims through bankruptcy courts. Marketplace's Henry Epp has more on why this issue ended up in bankruptcy court in the first place and what might be ahead for plaintiffs.
Johnson & Johnson is not bankrupt. It's a profitable company. But 4 years ago, it created a subsidiary to handle its liabilities related to baby powder lawsuits.
People have called this maneuver the Texas two-step.
Melissa Jacoby is a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. She says this strategy uses what's called a divisive merger to create the subsidiary, a move that's accepted in Texas. The intent is to shield a company from litigation costs. But she says J&J was unique in its attempt to use the bankruptcy process to handle current litigation and protect itself from future legal claims over talc products.
Bankruptcy is not the intended venue for profitable companies to cap their liability for an alleged harm.
Federal courts rejected J&J's bankruptcy claims twice because the company was not in financial distress, Jacoby says. This third attempt was rejected for different reasons. Plaintiffs were given a chance to vote on whether to accept a settlement, and the judge found irregularities in that voting process. Carl Tobias is a law professor at the University of Richmond.
And it wasn't entirely clear what those irregularities were, but they were enough to convince him that it shouldn't go forward.
In a statement, Johnson & Johnson says it won't appeal the latest federal bankruptcy court ruling. Instead, it says it will litigate tens of thousands of claims in civil courts. Tobias is skeptical the courts can handle that.
That will be impossible in the system as it's set up now. Just could not take on that volume of cases.
J&J, Tobias says, might reach settlements, but that could take a while. And plaintiffs have already waited 4 years as the company attempted to handle claims through bankruptcy court. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up 46 points. That is 0.1%. The S&P 500 is pretty much flat. The NASDAQ is pretty much flat. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.17%. And the 30-year fixed mortgage rate fell slightly to only 6.71%. More people than expected were added to private company payrolls last month. That's according to payroll processor ADP. It says companies added 155,000 jobs in March, up from just 84,000 in February. And the deadline for TikTok to be sold or shut down is this Saturday. Yes, we are going through this all over again. President Trump delayed this deadline back in January after he took office, and he could delay it again. He's reportedly reviewing a deal to get it sold and therefore keep it operating.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the cars, trucks, and vans that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks. More at ProgressiveCommercial.com.
More than 60% of all purchases last year were made with a credit or debit card, according to the Federal Reserve. That is up from 45% in 2016. And it has meant a lot of money for credit card companies. They made more than $187 billion last year in processing fees alone. For businesses that take credit cards, especially smaller businesses, that is an increasing expense. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Mac Hay owns a bunch of seafood restaurants and markets on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and he says credit card swipe fees are kind of like taxes.
You just kind of take it as a fact. It's sort of like, well, I guess we're going to have to pay them. We're going to have to pay the credit card processing fees.
More than 90% of his customers pay with a card. It's not like he's not going to take them. So he doesn't think about it much until the end of the month comes around.
When I see what we pay in credit card fees, it's astronomical.
Restaurants tend to have thin profit margins, maybe 5-10%. Erica Palmer at the Independent Restaurant Coalition says for many, paying between 2-4% of every sale to process a card is tough.
I talked to a restaurant last week who is paying $15,000 in swipe fees a month.
Bigger businesses can often negotiate slightly lower fees, but small ones don't have the leverage. And
Visa and MasterCard dominate the credit card market in the U.S. 80% of credit card transactions are going through those two processors.
So she says there's not much pressure to offer competitive rates. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report.
Mm-hmm.